Miami, and there was this guy in the back that didn't say anything until about the last class, and then he spoke up and really had really good ideas. And I caught him afterwards, and I said, Art, what you got to learn to do is to speak up. You got good ideas. And that was 10 years ago. And so now, I'm sorry.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lee. Before I start, I'd like to introduce three people that are with me. I consider them the real experts. They are beautiful, gifted, dynamic individuals. I learn from them every day. Two of them are black women. We all know that black women are the most beautiful, most creative, most endearing, most dynamic, the most loyal creations in the history of creation. I'd like to ask them to stand. Mrs. Elizabeth Robinson was a member of my staff. Mrs. Betty Moore was a member of my staff. And the very dynamic 1972 version of Nat Turner, Reverend Dave Gilbert, who is a member of our staff. I always like to have them with me because they are a source of inspiration to me. I always like to have them with me because they have been with me through some very rough situations, and I know that I can always depend on them. My remarks are often misinterpreted. Usually after I speak to white people, I have to go back and spend the next 3 or 4 days answering letters, explaining what I did not say. That is a waste of time and effort and energy. So let me begin by attempting to be very clear to you about where I am coming from. Number one, I got an F and a D in Latin at Shoemaker Junior High School from a white racist. But I did remember one of the lessons that he taught me. Repetitio est mater studiorum. Repetitio est mater studiorum. Repetition is the mother of study. So let me say to you, number one, I am not a communist. Number one, I am not a communist. Number one, I am not a communist. Repetitio est mater studiorum. I am not a communist. I believe in the precepts and the concepts of democracy. I believe, however, that democracy in this country applies to approximately 5 to 10% of the population, and consequently, what we are trying to do is make democracy a reality for everybody, not just a few privileged white people. I repeat, I am not a communist. In fact, to quote James Baldwin, who was quoted on page 95 of Floyd McKissick's 3/5 of a Man, I love America more than any other country in this world. And it is precisely for this reason that I reserve the right to criticize her perpetually. If you have a 5-year-old child, and that 5-year-old child runs out into the street when the light is red, you spank that child, not because you hate that child, not because you do not respect that child, but because you love that child and because you do not want to see that child injured. White people, whenever they are confronted with black ideas, automatically associate those ideas with communism. Repetitio est mater studiorum. I am not a communist. Number two, I do not hate white people. Repetitio est mater studiorum. I do not hate white people. I do not hate white people. I do not hate white people. As a matter of fact, some of my best friends are white. Let's deal with the basic rights that young people have. Let me say that it's impossible to separate the rights of young people from the racist, oppressive conditions that exist in this society. Now, I will be talking to you from Sam Yetz, The Choice, the issue of black survival in America. I will be speaking to you from Stanley M. Elkin's book, Slavery. I will be speaking to you from Angela Davis's book, If They Come in the Morning. I will be talking to you from Stokely Carmichael and Charles Hamilton's book, Black Power, The Politics of Liberation. I will be speaking to you from Nathan Wright Jr.'s Let's Work Together, and from Nathan Wright Jr.'s Black Power and Urban Unrest. We'll also be talking to you from H.Rap Brown's Die, Nigga Die, from Jonathan Cazale's Free Schools. And I'll be talking to you from an article in the Harvard Education Review, August 1970, by Dr. Ray Rist. We'll also be speaking to you from Alvin Toffler's Future Shock. And I'll be speaking to you from Harvard Education Review, May 1972, an interview with Arthur E. Thomas. I will also be speaking to you from what I have learned in my associations with Mrs. Robinson and Mrs. Moore and Reverend Gilbert and Mrs. Cooley and Mr. Washington and Mr. Campbell. And I will be speaking to you on the basis of what I have learned from my children in 7th grade classes, in 8th grade classes, in 9th, 10th, and 11th grade classes, in kindergarten, and in 1st grade. And I will be speaking to you from the wisdom given to us by a very beautiful black woman at Central State University who told us that we were not dumb and that we could learn. That lady, Mrs. Wilhelmina S. Robinson, Associate Professor of History at Central State University. I will be speaking to you from lessons learned from Dr. Ames Chapman and from lessons learned from Isaac Saplane. And I will be speaking to you from a lesson learned from an individual that I consider one of the great scholars of our time. That lady is my mother. And the most important lesson that I learned from her is a lesson that was taught me when I was approximately 7 years old. We were walking down the street in Philadelphia, and it was very cold, and it was very bad for black folks at the time. And I saw a very old, dirty, tall man. And I said, "Mom, look at that old, tired, dirty man." And he was dirty. He was filthy. And I remember this especially because there was snow on the ground and he had no shoes on. And my mother told me at that time, "I want you to always remember that were it not for racist white people, that old, tired, dirty, filthy man could have been president of these United States, could have been an outstanding basketball player for the Philadelphia Warriors, could have been the president of a large corporation. And I want you, she said, to always remember that there but for the grace of God go you. And she said, I want you to always continuously fight to make sure that the man on the bottom does not stay at the bottom. And I never forgot that lesson taught me by a very beautiful, brilliant lady who has been a constant source of inspiration to me. I will be speaking to you also from Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed. First right that a child has is the right to an education, a right that is being deliberately denied him by a white, racist, oppressive society. The second right that a child has is a right to due process of law. The third right that a child has is the right not to be physically beaten. It has been against the law in this country to beat sailors for 100 years. It has been against the law in this country to beat women for 100 years, but it is still perfectly legal in 42 states to corporally abuse children because of the frustrations, ignorance, and anxieties of teachers, mine included. Child has the right to freedom of expression in what is supposed to be a democratic society. And a child has the right not to be integrated unless he chooses to be integrated. A child has the right not to be integrated or desegregated because there is no such thing as integration in this country. Child has the right not to be integrated unless he chooses to be integrated. In fact, my experience with white oppression has led me to believe that white people automatically want black people to have the opposite thing that they say they want. So the logical thing for black people to do who are pushing integration is to ask for separation, and then white people will insist that you integrate. A child has the right to practice democracy in the classroom. How do we develop a democratic society using autocratic strategies, methods, etc. in the classroom? Child has the right to become a full-fledged member with all privileges on a board of education at the age of 7. I submit to you that in a country where you are supposed to be represented by your peers, a 65-year-old that sits on a board of education represents perhaps 2 or 3 65-year-olds that attend night school. At least a 7th grader sitting on a board of education would represent all of the 2nd graders in that school district. And I would refer you for further clarification on those remarks to Margaret Mead's Culture and Commitment, a study of the generation gap, where she defines the post-figurative culture as being a culture where the old teach the young, where she defines a co-figurative culture as being a culture where the old and the young learn from their own peer groups, and as she defines a prefigurative culture as being a culture where the young teach the old. I believe, as she believes, that we are moving into a prefigurative culture where we, in fact, will have to admit that there is a great deal that can be learned from young people. I believe, as Paulo Freire believes, that we must change the entire teacher-pupil relationship to the relationship of teacher to teacher and pupil to pupil. I believe that we have to understand that knowledge does not automatically flow from teachers, and that teachers are not always on the case as far as accuracy of information is concerned. That in fact, one of the real reasons that children have reading problems is because of the fact that teachers cannot read. and are not interested in me. I believe that young people have to run their own federally funded programs. Just as they have to run their own federally funded programs, they have to run their own schools to a degree. They have to determine their own destiny. I believe that students have the right to hold administrators and teachers accountable for their atrocities, for their actions, for their misconduct, etc. And students and parents have the right to criminally prosecute teachers for the criminal acts that they are guilty of relative to the miseducation of black and oppressed children. Now, as I talk to you, many people will say black children are not the only ones that are oppressed, and they are correct. My area of expertise happens to be dealing with black child. I realize that the Chicano has the same problem. I realize that the Puerto Rican has the same problem. I realize that the Asian has the same problem. And I realize that to a limited degree, the poor white child has the same problem. But many white people like to automatically say, well, there are some white people that have problems too. That is right. But always remember, never forget that to the poorest, dumbest as far as knowledge is concerned, most unfortunate white man in the world, Thurgood Marshall is still a nigger. Ed Brooke is still a nigger. And that poor, misinformed, miseducated white man has the psychological satisfaction of knowing that he is white. Therein lies the difference. And I'm saying to you that if we solve black problem in this country, we have solved the entire problem. So don't minimize what I am saying relative to the oppression of blacks by saying that some white people have it difficult too. True. But check the statistics. Check the record and you will find that we still catch a lot more hell than the white man does at any level. What are our short-range goals relative to what we are trying to accomplish? The first short-range goal that we have to deal with is to develop within every black child a positive self-image. School does a beautiful job of deliberately destroying the way the black child feels about himself so that he cannot compete with white children. The second short-range goal is to introduce real democracy into the public schools. Barbara Sizemore says, if we do not get about the business of practicing democracy in the institutions that have the responsibility of socializing our children, then we will never realize a real democracy. You can get that quote from Barbara Sizemore in the Congressional Record Select Committee on Equal Educational Opportunity, August 5th, 1971, the Mundell Committee on Equal Educational Opportunity. We have to educate young people about what their rights are so they will know how to deal with the oppressed or. We have to prepare our young people for the future if we are going to prevent genocide, as brilliantly articulated by Sam Yet in Detroit. We have to develop a short-range strategy to criminally prosecute teachers and administrators because they are guilty on a daily basis of premeditated, malicious criminal acts. And I see no basic difference in what many teachers do than in what the dope pusher does and in what the man who is convicted of armed robbery does. The results are the same. In fact, the teacher's results are in many cases a lot more damaging because they affect more people. Long range, we have to take a critical look at the whole educational system. I agree to a large extent with what Ivan Illich is saying when he talks about the deschooling of society. I agree to a large extent with what Everett Reamer is saying when he says school is dead. But they are white men, and they can afford to talk about the deschooling of society. And the problem I have with Ivan Illich's deschooling of society is that he does not give me a good explanation relative to who will run that deschooled society. If it is going to be controlled by the same white racist oppressor that controls this one, then I would just as soon maintain things as they are. At least I have learned to deal with the sophisticated form of racism that currently exists. The reason I have problems with Everett Reamer's school is dead concept is because while he talks about school being dead, he does not deal, in my opinion, with the fact that while it is being buried, many black children are being destroyed by that system every day. But I do think we have to take a critical look at the whole system of education. I do think that as it is currently constructed, it functions for business purposes relative to the black child. The black child is used as a tool for a $61 billion a year enterprise. School functions to sell toilet paper, it functions to sell typewriters, it functions to pay teachers so teachers can put their money in banks so banks can make money. It does not function for the black child. In fact, the black child is a tool used by that structure for head counting purposes so it can qualify for money. For further clarification on what I'm talking about, I would refer you to Black Scholar. I would refer you to Barbara Sizemore. I would refer you to Dr. Donald H. Smith, Dr. Ermine Hogan, and Preston Wilcox in a book entitled Racial Crisis in American Education, edited by Dr. Robert L. Green. We have to break the educational monopoly. Public schools function as monopolies. Public schools viciously make sure that alternatives are not able to develop and operate. So what we have to do is get about the business of breaking the monopoly held on education by public schools, and further documentation of what I'm talking about can be found in the Congressional Record, April 18, 1972, The Right to Be Somebody by Dr. Arthur E. Thomas, where we deal from a legal perspective, from a sociological perspective, and from a psychological perspective with the need to break the monopoly held by the public school system. We have to change minimum standards in the black community relative to state control. The school likes to talk about minimum standards, and we have to start, if black people are going to survive, to talk about maximum standards. And we have to move for control. And you cannot separate control of resources from schools. We have to move to control land. We have to move to control money. We have to move to control knowledge. We have to move to control power. We have to move to control all resources by any legal means necessary. Now, I think that public schools, I know that public schools in black communities are doing precisely what they are designed to do. Public schools' job is to transmit the cultural heritage. The cultural heritage in the United States of America, as defined by Kerner, as defined by Philip Hauser, as defined by the white expert on black people, Thomas F. Pettigrew, is a cultural heritage of institutionalized racism. Therefore, the public schools' job is to transmit that heritage. Therefore, the public school's job is to transmit institutionalized racism. The public school's job is to make sure that black children are not educated so that they cannot compete with white children for jobs. For further clarification on what I'm talking about, I refer you to the school legend by Greer, and I refer you to Ray Rift, August 1970, Harvard Education Review, because what Ray Rift says in his article is that teachers, as early as the kindergarten level, treat the black woman whose child is on welfare, treat the black child whose mother is on welfare, as though she thinks she is supposed to treat the child who is on welfare, and treats the doctor's child as she thinks she is supposed to treat the doctor's child. The results being the child is destroyed at the kindergarten level, and it is premeditated, it is deliberate, it is malicious, and it is criminal, and it has to be dealt with as quickly as possible by any legal means necessary. In my opinion, what many white Americans have decided is that there is no more cotton to pick, there are no more ditches to dig, consequently black people are no longer necessary, consequently there must be strategies developed to eliminate black people, and that is one of the functions of the school. The school is a legal, certified agent of genocide for black children, and it does its job very, very well. Now let's look at a pattern that has been developing in this country. I submit to you that certain social scientists, certain white teachers, and some black teachers, as defined by Nathan Harris and the black Anglo-Saxons, E. Franklin Frazier and the black bourgeoisie, and Alvin Toussaint in the March 1969 Ebony magazine, are dealing with a black psychiatrist looks at black power. But let's look at the facts. I submit to you that social scientists and some white teachers serve the same purpose here in America that those men that dropped napalm and destroyed Vietnamese children served in other places. The result is the same, deliberate and constructive, destructive death. Let's look at it. Title I program went into operation. Now, the very nature of compensatory education is racist. Because what they say with compensatory education is there's something wrong with the child. And for further clarification on what I'm talking about, I would refer you to William B. Ryan's book, Blaming the Victim. I would refer you to an article in Social Policy by Mario Fantini, The Educational Agenda for the 70s. But what they say is the child is culturally disadvantaged. The child is culturally deprived, which implies that there is something wrong with the black child. Well, I'm telling you right now that there is absolutely nothing wrong with the youngster. There is something wrong with the institution called the school. There is something wrong with the racists that run the school. There is something wrong with the people in power that permit black children to be deliberately destroyed. But there's nothing wrong with the child. That is the same strategy used during slavery that I will comment on in greater detail later on. Now you have the Elementary Secondary Education Act of 1965, wherein they gave more white people more money to educate black children that they had miseducated before. Check the record on who directs Title I program, white people. Check the record on who develops the proposal, white people. Check the record on when the black community is asked for its suggestion after the proposal has been funded. So you still have white people making decisions for black people. Now, other thing that you have to consider is the fact, I repeat, the fact that that most white people in this country have never considered black people human beings. We have always been considered subhuman beasts to most white people. The reason it was very easy for Thomas Jefferson and other founding fathers to come out with such beautiful remarks about all men being created equal, etc., was because they did not consider black people men. They considered black people animals. They considered black people savages. They considered black people beasts of burden. And I must compliment you in that you have done an excellent job of carrying out their traditions, be they right or wrong. Fact is, white America hangs on to an institutionalized racist structure developed by George Washington and others. Now, in 1975, that will be 10 years of billions of dollars being pumped into the black community to educate socially disadvantaged, quote, black children. And what will the record show in Congress? These children cannot learn. No matter how much money you pump into white hands to educate them, they simply do not have it. Now, while that is going on, because remember, the white man has always spent millions and billions of dollars to develop a record. So we have, or we will have soon, 10 years of compensatory education showing no results. Now, while the racist-controlled Title I program, which now has a black director, and the black director, who is the man that I have the utmost respect for, was placed there after the program had been corrupted and destroyed so that the great white father could say, well, the black man directs the program. The same strategy used relative to a lot of situations in this country. After something is totally destroyed, it's turned over to a black man. And then when the black man has difficulty bringing it out of people are such a problem to this country. Now, Moynihan obviously has not read Frederick Douglass's narratives. He doesn't know about the fact that Frederick Douglass's mother walked 20 miles just to be with her child because of the fact that she was owned by one slave master and Frederick Douglass was owned by another. Now, he obviously has not read Andrew Billingsley's work on the black family, Billingsley being the academic vice president of Howard University, the expert on the black family. He hasn't read Dr. Hill's work on the black family, Dr. Hill being the National Urban League research director who has written a book on the black family. He hasn't dealt with Dr. Jacqueline Jackson's work on the black family. He has misinterpreted E. Franklin Frazier's work on the black family. And he obviously hasn't dealt with Nathan Hare's The Black Anglo-Saxons. And he obviously has no knowledge of slavery as described by Lerone Bennett in Before the Mayflower, as defined by Dr. Charles H. Wesley, as defined by Carter G. Woodson and others. Because what Moynihan says is that the black woman is a problem. She's a matriarch. She is domineering. And that the black man is shiftless and no good. Moynihan does not write in that book the fact that the black family was separated on the coast of Africa, the fact that people with different types of speaking abilities or with different languages were deliberately placed together so that there could be no attempt at revolution or insurrection on those ships. And if by some great chance a black family did get to these shores together, black mother was sent to Maryland, the black father was sent to Georgia, and the black child was sent to South Carolina. So I ask you, who destroyed the black family? Moynihan doesn't deal with that. He says the black woman is domineering. Black woman has made it possible for black people to survive. One of the problems of the black family is that the black man is not afforded the job opportunity that the white man is afforded. And the other problem is that the black man is deliberately placed in jail by a racist police department, deliberately shot by racist cops, deliberately placed on the front lines while whites become radio operators so that more blacks die on the front lines and have historically died on the front lines in war. Deliberately forced into crime and drug addiction. He doesn't deal with that. In fact, I would suggest that you read Lerone Bennett's most recent book, The Challenge of Blackness, which correctly describes the problem in America as being a white problem, not a black problem. Now, the point I am making is that racist white scholars, quote unquote, like Moynihan, Jansen and company are deliberately building a record that says no matter what you do for black folks, they cannot learn, they are unnecessary, they are drones on this society, and they have to be eliminated. It's not an accident that in the United States of America, every time one white baby dies, three black babies die. And it is not an accident that the average black man has a 7 year shorter life expectancy than the average white man. It's not an accident that the average black man with a college degree makes $3,000 less than the average white man with a high school diploma. It's not an accident that the average white man with an eighth grade education makes $3,000 more than the black man with a high school diploma. Those things don't happen by accident. They happen by design. It's not an accident that drugs flow freely in the black community. Drugs serve the same purpose in the black community that those concentration camps that Hitler had served during World War II. It is very difficult to just pick black people up, put them on trains or buses, and put them in concentration camps today because those satellites beam that stuff to the world in a short period of time. Therefore, a sophisticated form of racism is to develop unemployment deliberately, develop psychological frustration deliberately, and then put drugs out there and say, look at those people. They are a problem. Look at them killing themselves. The only time we had a real push from anybody on dealing with the drug problem was when young white folks trying to be hip started messing with drugs. What we have to do immediately in black schools, I'm talking to black people now, is develop within children a positive self-image. You know, children come to our office and they say, Art, I wish I was dead. They say, Art, I would rather work around dead people than to work around live people. They say, I wonder who would care if I got hit by a truck. Their self-image has been destroyed. I refer you to Kenneth Clark's Prejudice and Your Child, or Prejudice and Your Child, where he describes the fact that black children, by the time they are 3 and 4 years old, have learned to hate themselves by a deliberately destructive racist society, or from a deliberately destructive racist society. How does this happen? Look at the dictionary. It's impossible for a black child to learn from an English dictionary without in fact being exposed to racism, without his positive self-image being destroyed, or without his self-image being destroyed. There are 120 synonyms in the dictionary for the word black. 75% of those synonyms have negative connotations. Black is dirty, filthy, unclean, bad. Then you have a black ball, a black male, a black list, and a black market. Let's go to white. 75 synonyms for the word white. Pure, virgin, chaste, angelic. Our children can't even sit down for a meal without being exposed to racism. Because the angel's food cake is white and the devil's food cake is black. It's funny, but it's destructive as far as the black child self-image is concerned. Columbus, some damn fool starts out for India and ends up off the coast of South America and gets credit for discovering something. I tell my children he was lost. He didn't know where he was going. But white people do a very beautiful job of protecting the folks that they have that mess up. Now, what did he discover? The Indian brothers were already here, so what did he discover? He was a dumb white man who didn't know where he was going. But the great white father of history cleans him up and says the great Christopher Columbus discovered the new world. Our children don't know about the fact that there were three ships, the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. And Pedro Alonso Nino was the captain in charge of one of those ships. Stereotypes. All black people are dumb. All black people are bad. All black people are stupid. Stereotypes that developed during slavery for the purpose of deliberately, psychologically destroying and controlling black people. As a child, my mother used to make us scrub the porch 3 times on Saturday before the white insurance man came to collect money to take it back to the white community. And then after we scrubbed the floors, we got our money to go to the movie. And for about 3 years, from the time I was 14 years old, I was like the rest of the young brothers, every Saturday watching those serials, rooting for Tarzan. Come on, Tarzan. Come on, Tarzan. Great white father, you can do it. Get the natives, Tarzan. Then I started analyzing and understanding what was going on. One day they had a brother that looked just like me on that screen. We could have passed for twins. So from that day forward, I said, come on, brother, get Tarzan. Then I started figuring it out. Here's a big, dumb, stupid white man, knows absolutely nothing but wah-ooh-ah, and he runs the whole damn jungle. The white man does a beautiful job of protecting the the white child self-image, talking about George Washington, talking about Abraham Lincoln, not telling black children about the 5,000 black men that fought in the Revolutionary War, not telling the black child about Phyllis Wheatley, who wrote beautiful poetry, not telling the black child about Richard Allen, who got up off his knees in the back of a white church and went to found his own in Philadelphia, not telling our children about Gabriel Prosser and about Denmark Vesey and about Nat Turner, not telling our children that a black man, Daniel Hale Williams, performed the first open heart surgery, not telling the black child that Charles Richard Drew pioneered in blood plasma. Our children are deliberately not told these things, so they go around with a defeatist attitude, so they go around believing that they have made no contribution to this society. I'm telling black folks that that has got to stop. Black children have to learn that they are the most beautiful people on the face of this earth, and they can do anything they make up their minds to do. In fact, in a paper that was just delivered at the National Urban League Conference, Dr. Watson, who delivered the keynote address in education, quotes me. And one of the things that I say is that if you ever notice a white man, one white man can walk into an audience of 2,000 black people and act like he is in charge. He comes in trying to be hip, asking questions, worrying you to death. 2,000 folks in there, just him. But he has been taught to act like he's in the psychological majority, even when he's in the physical minority. So I suggest to you, as Lerone Bennett has suggested, that the issue is not separation or integration. The issue is liberation. And what we have to do is develop the black child so that he acts like he's in control. He believes in himself, whether he is surrounded by 2,000 white folks or whether he is surrounded by 2,000 black folks. We have got to redefine violence in education. It's violent to hit somebody, but it's also violent to call a child dumb. It's violent to call a child bad. It's violent to look at a child and communicate to him in a nonverbal manner that you think you are better than he is. Those are forms of violence. And what we are trying to do is develop a strategy for criminally prosecuting teachers that exercise those types of violence relative to black children. A nine-year-old was watching the Today Show one time. This nine-year-old saw a brilliant black PhD on the Today Show. And this nine-year-old went running to his white teacher, and he said, "Hey, Miss Jones, how much money do it cost to go to school? I want to go to school and be like that black doctor that I saw on the Today Show." And Miss Jones said, "Sit down, because you are bad, you are dumb, your parents don't have any money, and you are late." So he did not come to school the next day. Two years later, he broke into a store. 4 years later, he shot somebody, and he's doing time right now. What I am trying to do is develop a strategy to hold Miss Jones as an accessory to the crime that he committed and see to it that Miss Jones gets the same time. At Shoemaker Junior High School, in 1950, a white man told me that I was bad, that I was dumb, that I would never be any good, end up in jail like the rest of my bum friends. I sent a chump a copy of my BS degree. I sent a chump a copy of my master's. I sent a chump a copy of my doctorate. And when I get my law degree, because black people have to be qualified, I sent a chump a copy of that too. But the damaging thing that he did was to tell my main partner the same thing. And my main partner did not come to school the next day, nor the next, nor the next, nor the next, nor the next. And he's doing long time in a Philadelphia prison right now because some white man destroyed his positive self-image. The psychologists tell us that we function at 15% of our capacity, which means we're all 85% better. And Vasily Divadov, the Russian psychologist at the Moscow Institute for Psychology, state that if folks use only half their brain power, if everybody in here used only half their brain power, they could memorize the encyclopedia from cover to cover. They could learn 40 languages, and they could pass the university requirements at 12 universities. Therefore, white teachers or black teachers don't have the right to limit a child's potential. They do not have the right to tell him what he cannot become. They do not have the right to deliberately destroy him by putting him in the general course. When I was directing the Model Cities Education Program, I went to a kindergarten class. The kids got there at 8, took a nap at 9, a nap at 10, a nap at 11, and they went home at 12. So I asked the teacher what she was doing. She said, you have to let these children develop slowly or at their own potential. You can't frustrate them. Self-fulfilling prophecy was in operation again. So I said, I'll tell you what you do, ladies. You get those damn blocks up now, and you start pushing them with some reading, some writing, and arithmetic. Because if you push them, and they learn enough to qualify for a job, if they need a psychiatrist, they'll have some money to pay for one. But if you let them sit there and do absolutely nothing, they'll be frustrated, they won't have any means of employment, and they'll need a psychiatrist and won't be able to afford one. The statute for robbery in the state of Ohio is to take something by force without permission. It carries a maximum, I think, of 25 years. I submit to you that teachers rob children of their creativity, of their desire to learn, of their initiative. I submit to you that they take these things by force without the child's permission. And what we are doing right now is trying to develop strategies to hold teachers criminally responsible for what they do, to take them to the county prosecutor and prosecute them in criminal court. A poor black mother can do that very easily because all she's got to do is get about 50 mothers that are registered to go down and impress upon the county prosecutor that he is an elected official and that they think they have a good case. And it won't cost millions of dollars. We can use the system on the system. They got my man Marcus Garvey, a beautiful black brother, for using the mail to defraud. I know of public school systems that send materials through the United States mail saying, vote for the school levy so your children can learn. I know that it is a fact that the children, in fact, have not learned. Therefore, if they could get a beautiful black brother named Marcus Garvey for using the mail to defraud, I see no reason why we can't get some school systems for using the United States mail to defraud. Embezzling. Kids come to my office every day with high school diplomas and they can't read. The public school system is guilty of embezzlement. The public school system is guilty of fraud. The public school system is guilty of every criminal act that you can imagine. And the individual teachers in that system are as well. And the individual administrators in that system are as well. And we're going to see what we can do about that. I refer you to a beautiful article in the Yale Law Journal, May 1970, by Edgar and Jean Kahn, where they deal with the rights explosion, the grievance explosion, and the new sovereign immunity. Now, Thomas Jefferson, even though he wasn't talking about us because he didn't consider us human, said, educate the masses and tyranny and oppression will disappear. That is correct. We feel that the media, the potential of cable television, the potential of radio, the potential of regular TV are tremendous relative to educating the masses so they can get the oppressor off their backs. A young brother came into my office a short while ago. He said, Brother Art, the teacher keeps messing with me. He was only 9 years old. He said, the teacher keeps messing with me, and if the teacher keeps messing with me, I'm going to knock the teacher down. I said, hey, little brother, be cool. Now, like, if you hit the teacher, you're going to be in serious trouble because, you know, teachers are always right, and teachers like George Washington never tell lies. So we worked and we worked and we worked on our strategy just like practicing for the school play. And he went back into that classroom and that teacher hollered at him and he waited for 20 minutes. And then when everything was cool and calm and quiet, he raised his hand. He said, Mrs. Jones, you have psychologically dehumanized me to the extent that I may be that I may never be able to adequately function again as a human being. And unless you refrain from treating me in such a manner, I may have no alternative but to take you to the United States District Court and charge you with a psychological tort, a mental injury. And to use my white training, Mrs. Jones doesn't mess with my young friend anymore. To use my black training, Miss Jones don't mess with my man no more. Now what I'm saying to you is the day we get 53,000 students to respond to criminal behavior of teachers that way, that's the day we'll get about the business of developing educational accountability. Suspensions. 18-year-old brother came into my office. He'd been suspended. He said, look, man, I'm going to off this teacher. I said, look, man, if you hit the teacher, like the teacher can have you picked up for assault and battery. If you let the teacher hit you, we can sue the teacher and probably get you a nice piece of money. He said, yeah. I said, yeah. So he came into the office recently. He said, hey, aren't you a jackass? He said, you told me that if I lay dead, that teacher might hit me. And I waited all year for that dude to hit me, and he hasn't hit me yet. And I was planning on using that money to buy my automobile, my ride. But he's in college now because he didn't hit the teacher. Black children are suspended because they are black, for no other reason. Black children are expelled because they are black, for no other reason. And if we have time, I'd like Mrs. Robinson to explain to you what she did on the suspension and the expulsion thing. Let me remind you that at our office, parents have access to law books. Parents know how to make decisions. Parents get about the business of making sure that their children are protected. So if they get me, it doesn't matter, because the parents have the information, the children have the information, and they can get about the business of protecting themselves. The general course, black children are deliberately shuffled into the general course. And you look at it. Ask a child in the college preparatory course what he wants to be. He'll tell you he wants to be an engineer, he wants to be a doctor. Ask a child in the business course what he wants to be. He'll tell you he wants to be an accountant, he wants to be a banker, etc. Ask a child going to Patterson Co-op what he wants to be. He'll say a plumber, an auto mechanic. Ask a child in the general course what he wants to be. I don't know, baby. I haven't made up my mind yet. They don't have any general jobs. Only thing the general course prepares black children to be are general fools. White people know that. Counselors that deliberately and maliciously advise black children to go into the general course are guilty of violation of the 14th Amendment that grants to all citizens in this country equal protection, because what they are doing by guiding those children into the general course is automatically depriving them of good housing, automatically depriving them of good food, automatically depriving them of good medical treatment. They are, in fact, killing them in a very malicious and premeditated manner. Now, what should we be preparing young blacks for? The United States government, the government of Japan, the French government are right now exploring the ocean. Because we have to get about the business of building cities under the ocean for black folks. Because if white people continue to treat us on the land like they're doing, and if we can anticipate the same type of behavior in the water, then I have no great desire to continue the relationship. I'm saying that the white man is right now developing plans for cities under the ocean. So the logical way to get rid of black people is simply not teach them how to read, write, or do arithmetic, so that there's no place for them in the future. Genetic research. I refer you to May 1972 U.S. News and World Report, where they tell you that they can make 22 million Hitlers right now if they want to out of a test tube. They can make 22 million Martin Luther Kings if they want to. I don't have to tell you what they did with the experiment on syphilis. That's genocide, pure and simple. And incidentally, Christopher Columbus brought syphilis to the New World. I'm sure white folks are interested in that amount of that bit of information. When white folks start pushing sickle cell anemia on the soul radio station, I have a real problem. Because what they're doing is using the media to reinforce in white people a false sense of superiority, and in black people a false sense of inferiority. Black sickle cell anemia, a black blood disease. They don't talk about the fact that it was a strength in the whole country. I'm saying that with the white man placing great emphasis on birth control in the black community, I'm saying that with the white man placing great emphasis on people with so-called low IQs not having the opportunity to reproduce, the white man is deliberately and systematically building the strategy for genocide of black folks. Medicine. We have to develop black doctors who have combination law degrees. Because as the transplant of the kidney, the transplant of the heart, the transplant of the lung, the transplant of the liver, etc., become more and more a day-to-day occurrence, who do you think they are planning on using for the spare parts? Us. Right now, it's funny. Funny, but right now, when a black child gets shot, or when a black child is dying from an overdose of drugs, right now, those white racist doctors call that black child's parent and ask if they can take that kidney. Right now, I refer you to the Billy Anthony case in Dayton, Ohio. Not in 1984, but in 1972. Urban space planning. Black people, you must not underestimate the white man. He will leave the polluted of earth to us. While he chops cities for his children on the moon and beyond. Now how can black people compete in that type of society without a basic knowledge of English, a basic knowledge of math? So I say to you that the school deliberately destroys the black child so that the black child cannot compete in that type of world. White teachers, you are agents of genocide, and you will go out and make your contribution to ensuring the mass elimination of black people. I know that. It may be, though, there may be one or two white people in here that have the potential of being JFKs or John Brown. I know that my black brothers and sisters are concerned. So I refer you to Black Bourgeoisie, Black Anglo-Saxon by Nathan Hare, and Poussin's new book, Why Black, Still Black, and Lerone Bennett's The Challenge of Blackness. Now, to the few white people that possibly might care, and to my black brothers and sisters that I know care, there is a possibility of surviving despite the fact that the situation is most pessimistic. So when you get a little weary and you just think that you can't make it, listen to Malcolm's record, Malcolm Talks to the Grassroots. Listen to Malcolm's album, Ballots or Bullets. Listen to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. at Zion Hill. Listen to the country preacher, Reverend Jesse Lewis Jackson. Listen to a record by Les McCann entitled Comment, where he says, if all men were born to be brothers, why can't we love one another? Somebody please second that motion. Listen to Aretha Franklin live at Fillmore West, where she says, reach out and touch somebody's hand, make this world a better world if you can. Listen to Brother Withers talking about leaning on me. Listen to Marvin Gaye when he says on what's going on, who really cares, who is willing to try to save a world that is destined to die. Listen to Marvin Gaye when he says, if you want to love, you've got to save the children. Listen to Marvin Gaye when he says, God is love. He made this world for us to live in and gave us everything. And all he ever asked of us was that we give each other love. Love your mother, she bore you. Love your father, he works for you. Love your sister, she's good to you. Love your brother and try your very best to save the children, if you care. Right. Things go wrong as they sometimes will. Road you're trudging seems all uphill. Cares are pressing you down the bit. Rest if you must, but don't quit. For life is queer with its many, many twists and turns, as each and every man sometimes learns. And success is failure turned inside out. Silver lining of the cloud of doubt. And you never, ever really know how close you are. Maybe near when it seems so very, very far. So I thank you, Mrs. Robinson. I thank you, Mrs. Moore. I thank you, Reverend Gilbert. And I thank the few folks in here that care. And remember, if you do care, that it is when things seem worse that you must not quit. Thank you.